The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Yeah, well, the team with the high-quality financial planning is Philip Tafe and Paul Larkin from IT Today. Gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you, Michael?
Very, very well. Of course, a lot of budgets and numbers and economics is on the tip of everyone's tongue because we've been told we're off to an election. Largely, that'll be a fought on economic matters, you would assume. And whenever you get this talk of elections, people, investors, do get just a touch nervous. They tend to hold their investments back until they understand who's going to win, don't they?
They do.
I've seen it in the last couple of months with clients who've been to speak to their accountants, and they've come to me saying, look, I need to get this done before budget night, because they've been quite concerned that there'll be some changes, you know, in advance. So it's already started. People are starting to shuffle money from left to right simply off the back of speculation. And when I've, I guess, broached that with some of my clients saying, well, you know, what are you basing this off? It's that they don't know the answers, so they'd rather get things done sooner rather than later.
Yeah, people are calling for early decisions and early, you know, to get an idea of what they're actually proposing. And obviously, we're not going to know. I mean, Turnbull and the government are skirting around what's going to be proposed, and tax is clearly, you know, a big target for them, and superannuation could be one of those targets, and the negative gearing, and so it's all up in the air at the moment. But yeah.
Super was one of the things that seems to be getting a bit of attention from the government side. There were some reports and rumours anyway in the Financial Review, I think it was last week, that the government could be looking at reducing the concessional contribution down to $20,000 per annum. That does seem very low.
It's getting very low. I mean, when the whole point of it is to encourage people to save for their retirement, well, if you're only able to save $20,000 a year, less the say 15% tax, you know, if you do that for your lifetime, it's still probably not going to be enough to fund you a very, you know, very decent retirement.
We're told that even with compulsory super at 8 or 9%, 10%, whatever it's going to end up with, that 80% of people will still be getting at least a part pension from the state. So we're not fully funding our retirement at all, yet they look at what they seem to be doing is saying, well, we've got a couple of trillion in the super pot, you know, job done, tick. We can reduce the contribution rate now so people can be captured in the tax system more effectively, and it seems very counterproductive.
Well, it's forcing people to save not just in super for retirement, but outside. But then that's creating this whole other debate about things like negative gearing, because that's generally the fallback position that people take is, okay, I've done all into super that I can, therefore I'll go do something else. What's the next best thing? All right, I'll borrow some money and buy a property or some shares. And now there's this debate around, have people taken too much advantage of that? And are those concessions too generous, and should they be cracking down on that? So we had that whole debate, a couple of months ago.
Well, it's just ongoing, isn't it?
Seems to be, yeah. I mean, with all of this, is it short-sightedness from governments of years gone by, which has led to the so-called loopholes, led to the so-called taking advantage of the current system, which they say they need to address, or are there genuine concerns that somehow people are just very, very clever in the way they utilise this? I mean, what's the whole story
here? Oh, well, I mean, negative gearing's been around for a long, long time.
Exactly.
You know, it's a very, you know, it's a straight-up tax concession, you know, to offset your income and get a deduction. So it's nothing really new, but I guess where the government is now with such a huge tax debt, and you know, we're in a position now where they need to pay that back, and they're looking at methods and levers to raise revenue. It was okay, you know, years ago when we had budget surpluses, introducing, you know, larger taxes at that point, you know, was able to be done. But right now, people are very, very wary and very scared of, you know, increases in taxes, and particularly in the superannuation area.
Yeah, I think the debate is more around the success of the system. You know, they created these rules to encourage us to save. Everybody's actually done that and are taking good advantage of it. And yeah, now, like Paul said, you know, we're not in a position where there's a big budget surplus, so the government sniffs around for, well, where can we take away some of these carrots, I guess.
Well, the simple story is this, isn't it, that we have saved, but the governments haven't.
Yeah.
And as a result, they're trying to balance their books because we've through us because we've balanced ours.
Exactly.
They're stealing it.
And that's the way it works. I mean, if you look, go back to the global financial crisis in America, the whole problem was with corporate America with too much debt. So the government stepped in and bailed out these companies. But effectively, all that happened was they transferred that debt from big companies across to the government. And obviously, at some point, there's going to have to be a payback. So, you know, corporations in America, they cleaned up the books. They were actually in really good shape. And now it's the government that's not in such good shape. And, you know, inevitably, they're going to have to either spend less or raise taxes. And I'm sure they'll end up doing a bit of both.
How much in this whole debate, and as we head towards an election, let's assume it's July 2, I mean, that's probably when it's going to be, how much in this debate is going to be generational, in that there's a lot of people, baby boomers and older, who do own their own home, that do have some money in super, that have played by the rules, worked hard, done the right thing, and been successful in retirement. But there are other people, say, from my generation and younger coming through, who simply can't afford to buy into the properties like their parents did, who are now looking at having all the contribution things that their parents got given in super removed. And there's going to be a bit of a generational gap in fairness, isn't there, in all of this?
And I don't think anyone's going to like the solution, because often it involves things like taxing estates. And I guess even people of the younger generation are probably going to be opposed to that, because they look at it from the point of view of, well, you know, I don't want to have to pay tax on something that I inherit from my parents.
From mum and dad, yeah.
So even though I guess it may help the society more broadly, I don't think anybody's really going to jump up and down with excitement if they look to solve the problem. So, yeah, absolutely. It's a generational thing. But it's all cyclical too, in my opinion. You know, we're at this phase where property prices are all the discussion because, you know, they've gone up quite significantly of late. But then we will have a period where that doesn't happen and everything, I guess, rebalances.
But it only rebalances if wages grow, and wages aren't growing. So, I mean, at the moment, as you know, property prices are astronomically high compared to an average wage. And if wage is growing at below inflation, that gap won't close.
No, but there might be something that comes out of left field that rebalances it. You know, it could be something as simple as
a cut to immigration.
Yes.
Not that it's going to happen, but it should.
It could be currency fluctuations around the world.
But an increase in interest rates here, but, you know, should cause property prices to level off as well. But what's going to cause that? Well, we need the economy to start performing better to get those rates, you know, moving upwards. And, you know, we've just seen the dollar appreciate nicely against, you know, the last week or so. It's up around $76. So the Reserve Bank's not liking that. So there's no sort of warrant to cut rates at all, you know, at the moment. So, yeah, it's you know, we're in pretty unique times with you know, the interest rates cycle, definitely.
And talking about getting the economy to grow, there is this rumble. This is the latest idea from Canberra. It probably won't happen, but this talk of a company rate cut. Of course, it seems that the personal income tax cuts are off the table, but maybe there'll be a cut for business. I don't know, 0.5%, maybe a little bit more. Would that do the trick for the economy?
Well, I think the company tax rate reduction was on the cards last election, from memory.
It was.
So, it's definitely something that's been flagged as, I guess, a change that's almost necessary. Because one of the catches is, I mean, that's why a lot of companies don't want to invest and operate in Australia, is because we've got a higher tax rate. So maybe if you lower the rate, incentivise companies to come in here and operate legally rather than with some of these more dodgy structures where they come here and they pay not a cent of tax, it gets the economy firing, it employs more people, and it is a way of turning the corner. So it's almost counterintuitive, though, isn't it? The government needs more money, they need to raise taxes, but let's achieve that by cutting a company tax and then hopefully broadening the revenue that we bring in.
Yeah, the productivity, you know, in theory, should increase.
Well, they say you've got to spend money to make money, but sometimes in tax you have to cut taxes to make money in the long run, don't you?
And in the meantime, good luck convincing the electorate that's the right thing to do.
Business deserve it and not them through bracket group,
I suppose. That's right.
Oh, look, it's always self-vested interest, isn't it? 131873 is the number. Of course, any personal finance questions, both Philip and Paul are here to answer those, so you don't have to talk about budgets on the national level. It might be your own private budget. In fact, that's what the calls are encouraged to do. 131873 is the number. Or send us an email, 2gb.com, click on feedback and we'll address it this morning between now and 1. Both Philip and Paul from IT Financial Services here to answer your questions, so take advantage of that. 131873. To both of you, with all of that said, let's bring it all now down onto the personal level. What investments can somebody have in their super fund?
Well, it's really dependent on what super fund you're actually using. I mean, there's unlimited amounts of super providers out there at the moment. But I think what we find is that most people fall into, when they start a job with an employer, they fall into a bucket in an industry type fund. And they outsource the investments to you know, the UniSuper or Rest or one of these large funds, and they're pushed into what's called a default option. They haven't made a choice, and they fall into a balance type fund. And in that sort of structure, you don't really have a specific choice around what your funds are invested in. The fund managers inside the super fund are doing that. Having said that, there are other options within that premix range, if you like. You could go from a balanced option to a conservative option and reduce your exposure to the share market, or you could increase your exposure to the share market going to a more aggressive option. But to really get flexibility and to target property, for example, or some individual shares where you can actually engage in investing in your super fund and get more involved in it, well, then you need to head down the self-managed super fund path. And for some people, that's appealing. But you really need to weigh up the costs involved in doing that and getting some good advice around what investments to choose there.
In terms of what you can invest in, I mean, you can boil it down very simply, and it doesn't matter which super fund you're in. It's either cash, fixed interest, which would be a term deposit or some kind of bond, property, and you can get access to property either directly by buying a unit somewhere or a house, or you could buy a property security, which would be something like, I mean, you've probably all heard of Stocklands or Westfield, and you can buy shares in those kinds of companies. And then more broadly, shares, whether it's in Australia or internationally. And then I guess the choice of super fund that Paul is talking about is more around how you access each of those asset classes. You know, are you interested in managing it very actively yourself? Well, then, yes, you might trade individual shares. Whereas if you're a bit more passive, you don't really know, you know, the way the system works yourself, that's where you might use a fund manager who invests in some of those areas on your behalf. So it comes down to, yeah, what kind of, I guess, investor are you? What's your level of expertise? It comes down to cost, because generally when you employ somebody else to do something for you where it's all packaged, you are paying a premium. And that's often where people leaning towards a wrap account or a self-managed super fund, you know, they're more interested in stripping out some of those costs and doing it a little more themselves. But I've got to say, even with, you know, a self-managed super fund, or again, most people we see dealing in that space, they're still getting advice. They're still coming to us and saying, okay, I've got a self-managed super fund, I've got X amount of money in it, but what do I do with it? Because the statistics that I've heard, where people aren't getting advice, most people just leave the money sitting in cash or buy a few shares. You know, they're almost paralyzed by fear about
picking the top and the bottom of the market and all this sort of stuff.
And what do I do? So rather than doing something, they tend to do very little. And I think that's where the value of maybe getting some advice, even if you are self-managing, can still have some important value.
Now, this might seem a completely obvious question, but for a lot of novices like me, it does need explanation. What is the advantage, or maybe I should put it this way, why would someone go for a self-managed super fund instead of relying on rather successful industry funds? I mean, they have returned good returns. You just tick the box, you leave it up to them, and the big boys with the suits, they sort it out, and you get your money at the end. People would say, look, a self-managed, that sounds like a lot of trouble to me. A lot of the onus is then on me to pick the winners. Why should I do it?
Well, Philip touched on it. For example, to own a residential property, that you can go to LJ Hooker and say, I want to purchase, you know, this investment unit in Rockdale for my super fund. You need a self-managed super fund to do
that.
All right? You can't do it through an industry type what they call a public offer super fund. So that's probably the first thing. I think the second thing is people, well, are enjoying the fad almost of being able to have control over what they invest their super in and having control to say, well, you know what, I don't want to outsource it to a bunch of fund managers or anyone else to look after it. I want to actually know and purchase what I want to invest in, whether it be cash or term deposits. But again, like we've touched on, there is a bit of fear with investors inside these structures unless they know what they're doing to actually to invest, you know, wisely and properly.
So the benefit is you can basically, from what you say, you can pick the investment options yourself. It broadens the scope of potential investment options.
Sure, it does.
Look, for me, it boils down to if I had $200,000 sitting in my own bank account, would I ever invest all of that with, you know, one balanced fund somewhere, you know, some manager? You never would. I mean, yet with superannuation, you just assume that you've got this chunk of money and you should be quite happy to give it to whoever it is, Australian Super, and just let them do it. So there's quite different mentality between money in your own bank account versus in your super, whereas really you should be thinking about it as, no, this is $200,000 of my own money. I should have some kind of interest in where it goes. But I guess the point is you don't have to have a self-managed super fund to take that interest. For me, a lot of people think I have to have a self-managed fund to
buy direct shares,
have that involvement or do these things. Mm. And really all the self-managed super fund is putting the onus on you to be the trustee of that fund and have all this compliance obligation, whereas you could outsource that through a good quality super fund that does all the headache work for you, and you can then just focus on, well, what investments do I want to choose within that super fund?
So we've got Jack and Jane listening out there now. They've got $320,000 in an industry fund. Would there be a benefit to them of moving that out and putting it in a self-managed super fund, or would they be better off, all things being equal, just leaving it in the industry fund and tapping it at retirement?
Again, look at the investment options they choose. Let's say they're really conservative and they just want the money to sit in a term deposit somewhere earning 3%. Well, often via a self-managed super fund, you might be able to shop around among all the banks and choose the one paying the best interest rate. Whereas if you were just with the bog standard industry super fund, they're only going to have one choice. You know, this is our rate, take it or leave it. And it's probably not going to be the best one in the market, may not be the worst, but it'll be somewhere in the middle. Whereas a lot of people say, no, in this low interest rate environment, I need to milk every little 0.5% that I can earn by shopping around and opening up accounts with different banks from time to time. And yes, that's a bit of effort, but you know what? I'm willing to do that every 3 months to earn a bit more interest.
Okay, we will take a break. We'll come back with some calls. 131-873 is the open line number. Any questions you have about your personal finance, about your super, about all these sort of things, give us a buzz. 131-873. Philip and Paul from IT Financial Services are here to take your calls and answer your questions. 26 past 12 on Tuesday morning. Great to have your company. We're talking, as we always do in the first hour of Tuesday's program, finance with the team from IT Financial Services. This morning, represented by Philip Tafe and Paul Larkin, and they're here to take your calls, 131-873. G'day, John.
Oh, hi. I've got a question about transferring a property to a relative.
Sure, John, yep.
It's a 5-acre block rural property.
Right, yep.
And I want to transfer it to my sister. She's a lot younger than me, and I'm 70, so...
Mm-hmm.
What sort of gift duties are involved? Are there such things still?
It's not so much a gift duty, but have you held it for a long time, John, and is there a big capital gain?
30 years, yep, there would be capital gains involved.
Yeah. So did you buy it before 1985?
No, unfortunately not after.
Okay, so that's your big issue. So even if no money changes hands, you are deemed to have sold it at whatever the current market value is.
Right, okay.
Which means you have to pay capital gains tax.
Got to pay the capital gains tax after I've done that?
So that's fine. So the only other cost really would be stamp duty and whatever legal costs are involved to draft up the, I guess, the change of ownership.
Okay, so you can make a gift to someone after you've paid the capital gains.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. That's most helpful.
No problem.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. That's what it's about. Give us a call. Any questions you want clarified, 131873. Boys, what about people who are about to retire? A lot of our listeners are sort of in that bracket, about to retire. How should they be preparing financially? It's one thing to prepare sort of mentally for, you know, not having to put the tie on and drive in at some sort of ungodly hour, but it's another thing to sort of be financially ready, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, it's even questions like what John asked, because we had this exact scenario in the office today, Paul. I mean, we were looking at a scenario where someone was saying, should I sell this property, you know, getting ready for retirement? And the question was, am I better off selling this property and paying the capital gains tax and looking to get this money into my super fund? Or am I better off not paying the capital gains tax and just hanging on to an investment which is a bit of a dud and isn't earning me much, but at least I don't have to pay the tax by getting rid of it?
That's exactly right. The real issue is, how long is it going to take to claw back the capital gains tax so that the money that's been lost in capital gains tax by shifting this property, the proceeds of the property, into the super environment, where in the long term you'll actually pay, well, zero tax on what the property's generating. So, look, those types of issues are extremely important, obviously. Where are the assets now? Are they sitting in an environment where they're paying, you know, the least amount of tax? Do I have an options and flexibility to move assets into either a super fund or into an area where I'm paying less tax? And then, obviously, you know, with retirement, how much are you going to need in retirement?
Yeah,
you know,
for me, that's the number one question.
That's the big one.
And the danger I think people fall into is they say, oh, I could live on less. You know, I'm earning this much now, but when I retire, I could live on less. And it's just not realistic. No. So the first step would be to do some kind of budget and be honest, you know. And also, if you're not sure, overestimate. If you think your car rego is roughly 1,000, make sure you say it's 1,200, because you don't want to go under. Because that's the biggest trap I see people fall into. We do all these projections, we show them, yes, you look okay, and then within 6 months they say, actually, I'm not coping, I need to take another $10,000 out of my
fund. It's not like they can just sort of walk down to the office again and put in some overtime to make up the difference. I mean, that's finished.
It's all over, yeah.
You're on a fixed income.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I'd be very conservative with your projections. You know, you say, look, if I need $40,000 a year to live on, let's assume that that increases quite rapidly every year with some kind of, you know, inflation. I would also assume there are a lot of one-offs on top of that. You know, there's always some medical expense. There's always the car breaking down. There's always a child or a grandchild getting married. You need to build those things in. And then work out how much you've got available to you to fund, I guess, that lifestyle, and then assume that that money doesn't earn much. Hopefully it does, and hopefully you do a good job managing it and you get some good advice, but what if you don't? You know, are you still looking okay, and is it still going to last you roughly as long as it needs to? And then I think the other mistake I see people make is they say, oh, look, you know what, I'm not very healthy, I'll be gone by the time I'm 80.
Well, the good old glass half full type, so...
Yeah. Or I at least want to have a good life till I'm 80, and after that I don't care. But you know what? When you get to 80, you will care.
How do you know?
We deal with
You're
it
not
a lot
there yet.
No. But I see a lot of people who care.
If you are, what's your secret? You look pretty good for 80.
Thank you.
All right, 131873. Hello, Mike.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your question, mate?
Look, I'm just wondering, I've got a fairly large amount of money in cash. I don't own any property. I've got about $1.5 million, and I'm thinking whether to buy some shares or property. What do you think would be the best shot to go?
Mike, it's a little difficult for us to give you a recommendation on air like this. We need to know a little bit more about your personal situation. But, we're happy to speak to you in the office during the week. You can give us a call. But, look, generally speaking, the share market at the moment, look, it's relatively cheap, and picking a bunch of shares to invest in is right now is a sensible time to do that if you're going to be, you know, picking some and investing in some good shares. How old are you, Mike?
I'm 57.
Okay. And are you in a position where you can retire? It sounds like with the sort of money you're talking about, you know, are you ready for retirement or?
Looking forward to it, yes. In a few years, I guess. Yeah.
Sure.
Well, you're right at that age bracket, I guess, where there are a lot of options. You know, yeah. It's not just about what to invest in, it's more where. Mm. So, you know, once you're over 55, retired, you can start accessing super. So potentially you could get some money in there, start up a tax-free pension and live quite nicely off that. Michael was mentioning off air that there's been some speculation about these transition to retirement pensions, maybe having the rules changed, you know, delaying your ability to access super. So I would have thought if you're in that position to be able to take advantage of the rules now, get in while you can in case they say that anybody from budget night onwards or some
future... They'd probably grandfather it, you'd imagine.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. But like I mentioned, I think that's why I've seen some accountants telling their clients to get in and do these things now, just in case.
But Mike, look, generally speaking, your situation, I mean, superannuation is, and we've touched on this tonight, I mean, you can invest in a whole range of assets and investments like you can invest in your own name. So you can do that inside a super fund. So you've got the ability to contribute some of these funds into a super fund. But look, like we said earlier, you'd be best to go and get some good advice around what structure is going to be best for you. So we're happy to speak to you during the week.
I've got one other question. What do you think about investing in the index itself, like with Vanguard?
Well, that was actually going to be my next point, actually, because the market as a whole, I mean, when you talk about Vanguard, that they're a passive fund manager. They basically say, we don't think you can do better than what the market does in the long run. So some fund managers are very active and they say, we can do better, but you tend to find, look, half do better, half do worse, and Vanguard says, we'll just take the middle road at a low cost. So you can buy a share like the Vanguard Australian Share Exchange Traded Fund. The code on that is VAS, V-A-S.
Yeah.
You can pick it up like a single share, and it basically mimics the top 300 shares on the stock exchange.
Yeah, so you're buying the whole market, essentially, yeah.
You pick up the dividends, and the market's yielding probably over 6%, which is probably about double what you'd get just keeping the money in cash. So for me, I guess if you're going to have some Australian shares, that is a good way to get a core exposure to it. But I would build more things around it than just that, because they're a great investment vehicle, I guess, but they're not the only thing you should have in a portfolio.
And look, there are active managers out there that have outperformed the index, you know, over various periods. I mean, that does go on.
Yeah, it's much easier for fund managers, for example, to outperform in the smaller company space because they've got a lot of expertise and are able to get in and out and make profits. I guess it's harder for them to consistently outperform at the big end of town, you know, with companies like the big banks, because they're so well researched. People tend to know pretty well what's going on with them, and it's harder to add value.
But Mike, you know, investing in an index fund, you're capturing the whole market there. It is relatively cheap. It's cheaper than what you'd be paying to an active manager. But is that the right investment for all of this money? I would hesitate to say probably not. But look, again, you need to get some specific advice around setting all this up properly.
Well, what do you think would be a realistic return on that sort of money with the share market? 10%? Can you still get 10 or 12%?
Well, not at the moment. You wouldn't be getting 10% in terms of overall return at the moment.
Not in dividend yield, but like I mentioned, the yield on the market more broadly is probably around that 6%+ when you factor in the franking credits.
When you factor in the franking, yeah.
So let's assume the share market doesn't go up in value with capital gains, you know, 1 cent in the next decade. You're still probably going to earn a bit over 6% per annum just in income.
But if you get some growth with it, Mike, yeah, look, I mean, in a good year, you could get, you know, a return of 12, 13, 14% in a good year when you include the actual dividends and the growth that, you know, you can get with the shares increasing in value.
But it won't be consistent, though.
It definitely won't be consistent, no.
Okay. All right. All right, well, thank you very much for your help.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for the call, Mike. And well, here's a good opportunity to give out the number for IT Financial Services. Either of you?
Yes, 02-9258-7500.
9258-7500.
That's the one.
We'll give that out again later in the program. 131873 is the number. Quick break. Back with more calls in just a second. Finance this first hour on a Tuesday morning. If you have a question, 131873. Now, understanding where you are financially can be daunting, but that is without IT Financial Services. They demystify financial jargon, provide clarity to your goals and aspirations, and will help you to develop your financial blueprint to work towards your lifestyle objectives. From financial lifestyle coaching, financial risk profiling, strategies and investments, to real life financial solutions. Just make one call to IT Financial Services on 9258 7500, 9258 7500, or go to itfs.com.au. You see, IT Financial Services are Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. They could make a real difference to your financial future. IT Financial Services, call them, 9258 7500, or in the interim, call us, 131873, and the team are here to help. And that's what Bob's done. G'day, Bob.
Oh, good evening, chaps.
Yeah.
Hey, Bob.
Is it good evening? Good morning, I should say.
It's morning, yeah.
Yeah. You guys are up late to earn your money.
Yes. Yep.
No, they're earning heaps of it. Don't worry about
it. I bet you do. The situation is, when you retire and the money runs out and all you got is the equity of your house, but you need all these repairs, like replaced hips and back repairs.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever, and you're staying in the fund, you can just barely afford to stay in to keep the hospital expenses there. But when you need these specialists, they all want the big gap fee.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Now, there is quite a few different ways of getting the money for the gap fees with using your equity of your property, isn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly one option, Bob, a reverse mortgage or equity release. They call these things a number of names, but yeah, you do have that option to draw some equity out of your home.
For me, that...
So the simplest and best, which are they?
If you were to come via our office, I mean, we would have our lending manager have a look at the whole market, I guess, see who's charging the lowest interest rates and, you know, best...
What sort of an interest rate does that work?
It's normally a bit like a home loan.
Yeah, it's a little bit higher. Yeah. You're probably at the moment looking somewhere around, I don't know, high sixes, mid-sixes, something like that.
The important thing for me is to find, I guess, a product where you're not paying interest. You know, let's say you take out a loan for $100,000 or something like that, but you only need $1,000 on day one. Make sure you're only paying interest on that $1,000 that you use on day one. You know, don't draw out the whole lot and start accumulating an increasing debt against
your home. Almost use it like a regular income payment. So you can secure a facility or the loan amount for $50,000 or $60,000 or whatever, because they have limits on the actual amount that you can borrow.
Do they have one where it's a small amount and as you need it, you could increase it to further?
You can. It's up to you as to what limit you want to apply for. And the banks, they tend to be fairly strict in terms of how much they'll lend you. It's based on your age. You know, the older you are, the more they'll lend you because they know they'll get their money back sooner. And
there's other parties, like your wife could be younger.
Yeah, and that comes into it. So they'll look at the age of the youngest person.
So how do they work at if you die, well, then they just say, sorry, old girl, we're going to sell your house?
No. The last surviving spouse, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just that the way it all goes, we all wonder if China might withdraw on us yet, and we'll end up with nothing.
Well, that'd be a good reason to get the loan in place before the values go down, so you can get your equity out. But these reverse mortgages, they are a last resort, but they are a fantastic last resort because, you know, this kind of product didn't exist 10 years ago from what I can remember. So when you're down to your last dime and it'd be really great to have $1,000 to, just take a trip somewhere or go visit the grandkids up north or whatever it is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You get older, you get hit quick with these replacement bits all of a sudden. They say, you need that. You know, you
yeah, big bills. All of a sudden, there's big costs coming through. Yeah, we see it all the time.
Mm. Old age isn't necessarily cheap. Yeah.
It doesn't matter how you beg, they just don't seem to want to give you a discount.
No, that's.
They want that big cash amount, the gap.
That's right. But Bob, I would definitely go and talk to a mortgage broker. If you need a referral to someone, give our office a call. There are a number of banks that offer these products, and some are definitely better with better terms than others. So you want to do your shopping around.
All right. Thank you, Bob, for the call. Hope that helped. 131873. On those reverse mortgages, again, you know, there's a lot of talk at the moment about them, article after article from commentators and I think the Centre for Independent Studies and all these people came out saying, you know, we really, the age pension is becoming unsustainable. There's less workers per retiree per head of population than there was 50 years ago. The retirees are sitting on two-thirds of $1 trillion worth of, or pensioners, two-thirds of $1 trillion worth of real estate as it's currently, quote-unquote, valued. So let's, you know, tap some of that capital that otherwise is simply bricks and mortar and then, you know, work out post-mortem the financial arrangements with the banks. Are you in favour of that?
I've got to say, when they were talking about, you know, somebody living in a waterfront mansion in Sydney, they've got no money in the bank and they're getting the full age pension, I thought one of the better suggestions I've heard more recently is to say, yes, that person can continue to have the age pension, but you know what? We're going to recoup some of that out of the sale of your home when you eventually pass away.
That would force a sale.
Well, they're not going to force, only upon death, I guess.
Otherwise, little rich Sung Tarquin would have to stump up, say, $200,000 out of his bank account to keep the house.
Exactly. And so it's not saying that the house has to be sold, and it's not saying that you have to receive the age pension either. But if you want to receive the age pension and still live in your $5 million home, well, okay, there needs to be some acknowledgement that, you know, the government recoup some of that eventually at the end of the day.
See, the problem I found with it, I raised this yesterday morning, was that In across the country, certainly across New South Wales anyway, we have a standardised valuation for land. But there's no one out there with a standardised measure for the house price. How on earth would you have... You would have to create a different position, some suited boffin, that is atop of the valuer general who says that this house is worth $1 million, not the land.
It's rife for manipulation,
and
isn't it?
And you can have a huge property out in, you know, in bugger all way out where... which, if that was on the water, would be worth a squillion. But because the land's worth nothing out there, you would escape all of this, you know, and you could have, you know, paid little tax and all, you know. And the bloke who's paid huge amounts of tax just happens to live at Mortlake or something, you know, gets stung. I mean, it would be terribly difficult to sell politically.
Oh, and that's where I've heard, you know, I guess people in Sydney would be disadvantaged, obviously, because, okay, you've got to live somewhere and you're not necessarily wealthy just because you've got a home to live in Sydney. So, there'd need to be some formula that acknowledges that different places in around Australia are valued in different ways.
Otherwise, it'd be a mess.
It would be difficult, but I guess... Theoretically, if you could get your way around some of those issues, it has some merit.
Mm.
And I've heard some very intelligent people speak, you know, very sensibly around...
In theory, it makes a lot of sense, but in practice, it sounds to me virtually impossible to implement.
And we all know every time the government gets involved with their hands on things, it
much harder.
Mucks it up, right? So I guess less involvement, the better. But we've also got a problem. I mean... The government's biggest line item is the age pension.
Mm.
So they're obviously looking around at how can they tinker with changes to improve the process.
As it stands at the moment, people do need to be careful with if they do decide to implement using a reverse mortgage or these equity release products that, you know, they need to be careful if they are in receipt of age pension, because they do actually, if you draw down that money and you accumulate it in your bank account, it will be looked at from Centrelink's eyes. So you've transferred money out of the equity in your home, but if you're building it in your, or sitting it in your bank account, or purchasing other investments, then Centrelink are looking at that asset value. So you need to be mindful of
that. Comes into the threshold test, doesn't
correct.
It?
Yeah, and that's why you only want to draw down on it as you're spending. You know, you wouldn't draw extra and leave it in your bank account.
Well, talking about all of that, to go back to where I asked earlier, the transition to retirement pension idea, it was in the Financial Review a couple of days ago saying that transition to retirement pensionism, which allows people to access a tax-free income stream from their super once they reach their preservation age, also likely to be abolished or limited.
Well, it's not exactly tax-free once you reach your preservation age now, so... At 55 at the moment, you can access your super via transition to retirement pension, even if you're working full-time. But there's tax to pay on that income stream. It's, you know, it's discounted. And
on
it's,
the basis that a portion of it is taxable inside the fund.
Correct. Right? There's components in your super. Mm. There's a tax-free component, potentially, and a taxable component, depending on how you've made contributions over the years.
But most people out there have a relatively large taxable component at the age of 55 because most of the contributions that are sitting in their super fund have come through an employment arrangement. So they have that taxable component. So like Philip said, you'll invariably pay tax on that money that you draw out of your transition to retirement.
Until you turn 60. And until that's when 60, the tax-free yeah. status really kicks in.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps if this sort of rumour bug is right, that will be altered. Now, that would affect a lot of your clients, I'd imagine.
Oh, it's one of the...
A lot of people advise people to take this out.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, why wouldn't you? You start up a pension, yeah. you get all these tax-free earnings, and then you can put that money back into your super funds at least until 65, even if you're not working. So, yeah, it's a great, I guess, tax advantage at the moment, and that's why we spend so much time talking about it. It's because it is a great strategy. The moment it's not is the moment we stop talking about it and move on to the next thing.
Mm. You might have some work cut out for you guys after May the 3rd. I think it's going to be the budget day.
Yeah, 3rd of May. Very interesting to see what's going to come out, yeah.
Very, very interesting. Well, we'll take a quick break. Back with more in a second. 131873 is our number. It is almost 8 minutes to one on the dot. 131873 is the number. If you've got a question about your personal finance, get in very quickly because we are almost out of time with our friends from IT Financial Services this morning. Philip Tafe and Paul Larkin are here. To both of you, how does one plan for the end of the housing boom?
Well, certainly if you're thinking about selling your home, and, I mean, if in fact the boom is...
That's
you know,
the first question.
Yeah, if in fact we are in a boom, but look, you'd have to concede that certainly in areas like Sydney and Melbourne, that house prices have, you know, really, really risen sharply, haven't they, the last sort of certainly 4 to 5 years?
Massively.
So if you're considering
and
selling.
And not even so much about the house prices, the issue is the debt associated
yeah, the
with
debt
it.
Associated.
That's what's causing the concern among economists.
But yeah, look, if you're looking at selling, potentially now's. Get in there and sell, you know. You know, if you're considering doing that, the market may come off 10-15%, who knows. So if you're going to be selling, now it would be an excellent time to do that.
What about this scenario then? Say you've got, you know, there's a bloke out there called, Phil or whatever, Colin
Michael.
Or whatever. And, yeah, they've basically got a self-managed super fund, which is basically a property. Mm. They've got nothing. They've got basically a property. Mm. They put a couple hundred thousand a few years ago. That's now grown the property value. They've got no real lot of cash or anything. You know, they're getting close to retirement. Would you advise they should flog that?
They'll get themselves caught out because where we were talking about transition to retirement pensions or even when you retire and just a normal account-based pension, once you're 55, you've got to draw out at least 4% of the balance. Once you're 65, it goes to 5% and then it keeps going up. Now, it's highly unlikely that your million-dollar property is actually going to be generating rental yield of 4 or 5% after all costs.
Mm.
So you're going to need something extra in your fund just to be able to draw out what the government says you have to. So I think people who've got most of their money in a self-managed fund tied up in a property at retirement are pretty much forced to consider selling that property.
But so even if they're a few years away yet from retirement, but it seems like the market's reached a fairly high watermark.
Yeah, yep.
Would you say, right, now's a good time to go and sell, capitalise it and put that into shares and cash?
Well, probably a very good reason not to, which is if you haven't started a pension yet, the super fund will pay capital gains tax of between 10 and 15%. Whereas if you delay selling that property until you've started a pension, there'll be no capital gains tax.
This is the transition to retirement pension.
Transition to retirement,
or just a straight out, or account, what they call account-based pension when you've actually retired. But
right.
Yeah, look, Philip's spot on the basis that in that first year of commencing the pension, that'd be the most sensible time to sell the property to avoid any CGT inside the super fund.
Mm.
But in that period leading up, well, once you've kicked off the pension, you do need to provision for the income payment that you need to receive, the minimum amount. So,
I guess you only need to take that annually, though. So,
yeah.
Potentially you could start the pension and have a full 12 months up your sleeve.
Sell the property in the first 12 months.
Sell the property and then draw out what you have to draw out within the
So this is why people need financial advice, because there are so many tricks and traps and
absolutely, yeah.
bits of data and detail, which you guys obviously make a living out of studying and imparting the knowledge. But you know, people out there think they're doing the right thing. They say, right, the market's at the top point, I'll sell, and you know, then I've got cash and whatever. But there's, you know, there's reasons maybe to hold on.
Well, there you go. I mean, the $1 million property, and somebody sells it in superannuation phase, accumulation, before they start this pension, and they end up paying, you know, 100 grand in tax or somewhere around that amount, which could be quite easily avoided if they got some good advice.
But in terms of planning for the end of the boom, I mean, the simplest thing for me, again, debt is the problem. So interest rates are low. Start paying off as much debt as you can. That'd be the most obvious thing that you could do, so that when...
Can you talk to the federal government about this? Because the theory is they're going to borrow more and for 30 years. Malcolm says, oh, well, you know, the interest is so low, we should... Well, the hint is we should be borrowing all this money and building things.
Well, I think people have. What we're talking about is preempting the end of the good times, and you should be building up a buffer, you know, get some money in your offset account, or make sure that your loan has a redraw facility. Sure, park some extra cash against it. You know, you can always get your hands on it again if you need to, but that's what's going to give you the protection if the worst happened and, I don't know, interest rates started going up rapidly, or for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe you have an issue with your job because the economy's had a downturn and you're laid off. So whatever extra you've got sitting against your home loan, provided you do have that kind of redraw facility, it can be accessed to buy you time and breathing space before you move on to your next job or get yourself sorted. I'd also be looking at, while the times are good, if you're going to be shopping around on home loans, do it now. You know, refinance now, because when times are tough, banks won't be valuing your property as highly.
That's right, yeah.
Again, maybe there's some issue with your employment. And so now is the time to be looking at any of these changes.
All very good advice. Very, very good session this morning to both of you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
And no doubt we'll see one or both of you together very, very shortly again. Of course, Philip Tafe and Paul Larkin there from IT Financial Services. It's 2 minutes to one.